So what we're seeing is multiple different things going on. One is global depopulation. So we're going to see huge human osmotic pressure as these economic and food issues and other, you're always talking about energy. As you know, that energy prices rise, all prices rise, right?
Hello and welcome everybody to this Off the Cuff. I am Chris Martinson of Peak Prosperity. Today, very, very special guest, Michael Yon, who really needs no introduction, but we probably should. He is a very decorated war correspondent. He's been up front. He's been there. I mean, if there's a front and then there's a front of a front, that's where Michael has done his reporting. And now he's hot on the trail of the migrant issue. Of course, he's been talking with me about it for a long time, brought myself and Brett Weinstein, actually anybody who he thinks can come and shed some light on this, he is willing to bring down. Michael, hey, so good to see you again, and glad to have you on the program.
Hey, thanks, Chris. Well, not just anybody I bring. Most people I won't bring. They have to be somebody that can be really special because, you know, time is precious. And obviously, the reason I've been asking you and Brett Weinstein for so long is because you bring special insight. And I've been watching your videos since you got back, and you didn't disappoint. I mean, you see things through the scientist's eyes that I wanted you to see it. And your analysis has actually been quite helpful for me. And just as I mentioned before, I'm bringing you down there to basically help me with my own knowledge set. And I've also been watching Brett's interview since he left. He was on Tucker, and that must have had 12 million views so far. And that's also quite worth watching. So now I'm about to go down with Epoch Times as well. And I've been asking them to go for a long time as well because they specialize in China, right? And as you know, you've seen the China aspect down there. And so I was with Epoch over in Hong Kong and that sort of thing. And you know, we've cooperated quite a lot on things since Hong Kong. So they're very valuable. But actually, most people that want to go, I'm like, yeah, sorry. I mean, you got to really bring something to the table, and you have. I mean, it's really been amazing what you've gotten out of this.
Well, thank you. I'm just trying to frame some simple stuff for people. I've been getting a lot of traction just trying to explain the difference between immigration and migration, because one of the tricks that the progressives, the lefties, the WF try and do is they try and take our words away from us and blur it all up. Oh, are you anti-immigrant? Like, no, that's a different process. That's a thoughtful, careful vetting process. We're talking about the mass movement of unvetted people from point A to point B. And you can't, like, that's a totally different process, right? So that's what they do, is they try and confuse us by taking our words away as they're running whatever programs they're running. But they think migration, in their own words, from their own documents, Amy Pope, all that, migration is always a good thing. It's a force for positive.
Yeah, I saw your video on that where you were breaking it down. You know, I've been through this word issue over and over and over in different wars and conflicts. Yeah. For instance, in the Civil War in Iraq, or let's say the Iraq War, during when I first got there in 2004, by January of 2005, I got there in December of 2004. And by January of 2005, I said, wow, there's actually a civil war component, right? It's not just a civil war. Often when you're in a war, there's multiple wars going on, actually, which is not, it's like, you know, you're a doctor. Somebody can have more than one disease, right? you can have multiple wars going on, right? And you know, wars within wars, they're like nested, right? And one component of the Iraq war, in some parts of Iraq, they were in civil war. In other parts, there was no civil war. It depended on where you were. But it was politically inexpedient, certainly in 2005, to say anything was a civil war because the Bush administration thought it would cause everybody to punch out. And so, to not be interested. But from my perspective, you need to call it exactly as it is because you're a doctor. You want to call something a fever when it's really cancer? You know what I mean? You have to treat it, and you can't just push it off because it's going to get you, right? And that civil war, so in January and certainly by February, I was starting to call it a civil war of 2005. And that was very politically heated. So people were like, with the immigrant versus migration word versus invasion, illegal alien or whatever, the same thing happened with that word civil war. And people are looking up, well, according to Webster's, blah, 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 blah. And you had, you know, these analysts and whatnot. I'm like, whatever your dictionary says, let me tell you what's going on here. It is a civil war. And I've seen all the definitions from 8 different dictionaries and the encyclopedia and all that. And I'm telling you, it's a civil war. Skip the bullshit, right? I mean, you know, but only in parts of it, because then they could also cherry pick and say, well, there's no civil war here. Like in Anbar province, there was no civil war. But in Diyala province, there was, right? And in Mosul, it's kind of mixed. So, I mean, you know, it depends, you know, depending on where you're at in different parts of Iraq. What I'm getting to is I stuck to that. And about a year and a half later, that's when people came around and said, yeah, it's a civil war. And I'm like, okay, now you're finally calling the fire department to treat it as a civil war after it's really grown out of all proportion. You got to call it what it is as early as possible, as early as you can diagnose it. Well, you talk about this all the time, early diagnosis and treatment, right? I mean, that's when I first started following you way back when, right? Early diagnosis and treatment. I mean, if you can do it, if you can get right off the bat, usually the huge problem, if you have a small kitchen fire, but you squirt that thing out, it's nobody even knows about it except when they come home and smell it. But it's the same way now with what's going on. People are niggling over the words. And this is we're in a war. I mean, this is a clear invasion. I'm way beyond migration and immigration. Now, obviously, with it, I've heard you talk about this very accurately, and Brett as well, that some of the people clearly are just migrating. I mean, but they are, you know, there are some people that are, for what, you know, whatever reason, the normal human osmotic pressure for economic reasons or whatever, right? There are some people that really are running from persecution, right? And in some cases, prosecution, especially a lot of the gangsters. But the vast majority at this point is a weaponized migration. And some of the people are clearly invading intentionally. Like you've met some of the Chinese at China camp, obviously called San Vicente camp down there. And you saw their behavior, which is getting increasingly like that. It's like 2 years ago, they were more friendly. Now it's like, you know, they're more hardcore now. And sometimes they're quite aggressive and threatening. I'm talking about the Chinese and also many of the Assyrians, many of the Haitians can be quite threatening.
Yeah. So let's start at the beginning. When did you first get onto this story about this migration pattern? When was that? And how did that come about?
Well, rewind the tapes to, I'm a war correspondent, so I pay attention to food issues, energy issues. Mm-hmm. I pay attention to the economies. Like one of my friends is an analyst. We've driven all over the world together. He's like, there you go, taking photos of gas stations again. You know, I'm always, you know, gas prices. I'm always watching the same stuff you always talk about. That's one of the reasons I started following you. Because you're analyzing on a higher level the things that I look at as a war correspondent. You know, it's not all shootouts. It's other stuff, right? And so I've watched migration and weaponized migration for, I don't know when I started. And so, so at some gray period in my background. And so I've been cognizant of it. And so, when Biden was installed, I was in Washington for the inauguration, not invited. So there was fences all over Washington. It was amazing how much it was many miles. I have no idea. And so as soon as he got installed, I flew immediately to El Paso with Misako Ganaha and Chuck Holton, whom you both know. And so we flew to El Paso, and immediately because we suspected they would start to flood the border. So then we flew down to Colombia to Darien, and then
how did you know immediately they were going to start flooding the border even back then, though?
Just keeping finger on the pulse. And also the thing I keep talking about is the paradigm. Right. And for instance, I've been working since I'm a teenager on developing paradigms that are predictive. I think I got it from Feynman, actually, because I used to be just a physics nut, man. I was addicted to physics. Mm-hmm. You know, when I started as a little kid, I started going into chemistry, and then I thought, no. I was always looking for the deeper truth. And then I transitioned over to physics, you know, because I always thought that's where you can find the rules that govern the universe, which Now I think I was wrong on that, but for about 10 years, I was just hardcore physics, man. And there was no YouTube back then. So I would be reading Feynman and reading, you know, all the big physicists. I was reading about relativity when I'm like 13 or 14, you know what I mean? So quantum physics, 15, you know? So, I mean, you know, it's like, so all this stuff is like it's part of my thinking structure on how I think. I think very scientifically because those were my mentors from afar, right? And one of the things, I think it was Feynman, he used to talk about, developing theories and whatnot, and you have to test them, of course. And if they don't work, then you either have to, something's wrong. Never get attached to it, right? And you get attached to your dogs, but never get attached to your theories, right? It's like, and if it's wrong, you either have to rework it, something's wrong with it, or throw the whole thing out, right? And so, over a period of time, I've been through so many throw the whole things out and, you know, just now this paradigm that I've developed for what's happening now, you know, whether or not it's actually based on the truth, I don't know, but it's become highly predictive, right? It's like, for instance, the difference between Newtonian and Einsteinian physics, right? Let's say the mathematics that describes gravity, right? I mean, you know, the calculus that Newton developed is good for, like, you know, dropping apples and things like that, or even launching rockets. But it's not good for making particle accelerators, right? Because now you're going relativistic speeds and what, you know. I mean, it's like, so it's a different. So, I mean, so I look at the paradigms that I developed for predicting what's going to happen like that. I don't really know what creates gravity, but I know that it's some math that seems to be pretty predictive, right? And likewise, in the paradigm that I'm operating under, for instance, the sex in the Senate, people were shocked. I'm like, not shocked at all. Totally expected, right? I'm not saying I predicted that, but I mean, but for instance, BASF and Nord Stream. Before Nord Stream was interrupted, I was in BASF twice with Masako. And the second time we were there, I asked that somebody, you know, BASF, the biggest chemical company in the world over in Ludwigshafen, Germany, they have a 10 square kilometer plant, right? They opened their nitrogenous fertilizer production there in 1914, actually the same year they opened the Panama Canal, right? And so two different countries, obviously, but all two of them very important for the entire world, right? And so and when we were in Ludwigshafen at BASF, I asked the person giving us the tour, what happens if Nord Stream gets interrupted? Now, this was before it was interrupted, right? And because in my paradigm, something probably would happen to it. I don't know. But I bought an extra iPad that I just kept beside me. There was a website that you could watch the flows through Nord Stream. And it would give you like minute by minute updates. And I would just, you know, as I'm working, I'd be like, Nord Stream's still flowing. Oh, it's decreased a little bit. It's up again. You know, Russia's cut it off for a while, whatever. And finally, it went to zero. And I was like, oh, interesting. So I was messaging people that I know. I'm like, did something just happen to Nord Stream? You know, some hours later, you see it bubbling up. And I'm like, wow. Something did happen to Nord Stream. But, you know, a lot of people are like, well, maybe a ship dropped its anchor. I'm like, maybe, you know, but but I don't think so, you know. And then last year, but what does Nord Stream affect? It affects a lot of things. It's a multi-purpose target, right? I mean, first of all, it cuts Russia from Germany, and it does a lot of things. But also the nitrogenous, and the reason I was at BASF, they get a lot of their natural gas from Nord Stream, right? And you need that hydrogen to combine with the nitrogen we're breathing to create ammonia, nitrogenous fertilizers, right? So this is a big deal, right? And now, last March, I left Panama, and I went over to Netherlands for the Dutch elections in March. And while I was there, I went up to Groningen, which is the biggest gas fields in Europe. So it's in northern Netherlands, little Netherlands. So I went up there and I was talking with farmers and stuff. And they were doing a huge information campaign about these micro earthquakes that are created when you pump the nitro gas out. It causes these sort of tremors and it cracks people's foundations and whatnot. But they, you know, they focus the camera on those and get everybody riled up. And so I was publishing, I think they're going to close Groningen, right? And so that was March and before, actually. Remember, I had already suspected it or I wouldn't have gone there last March. And sure enough, maybe, I don't know, 5 or 6 months ago now, they closed it, right? You can find online. That's the biggest gas field in Europe, right? So why did I suspect they would close Groningen? Why did I suspect Nord Stream would get interrupted or that Darien Gap would become a major corridor? Because it fits the paradigm, right? And anytime if you're developing a paradigm, it has to meet two criteria. One is you should not be surprised. If anytime you feel the emotion of surprise, not the kind of surprise when you wake up and there's a snake in your bed, but I mean the type of surprise where wow, I didn't expect that. I can't believe they did that. That means your paradigm is off, right? So go ahead and anytime you feel that emotion of surprise, recalculate, you know, your GPS, right? You took the wrong exit. recalculate. So do what Feynman would do. Hey, your hypothesis, your view of the world is off somehow. So keep adjusting it or throw the whole thing out sometimes until you have a working model that's predictive. And you can do it. You can do that on a lot of things, right? And so eventually you get to the point where I'm like, I think they're going to open Darien Gap. It was already open. It was like an ant trail more at the time. But I was publishing just within like a month of Biden being installed that I think this is going to become a major corridor. So I started putting a lot of effort there. So I would go back to Panama, off to Netherlands, off to Japan, off to wherever, Italy, Greece, you know, Morocco, Lithuania. I was in Lithuania before the war broke out. And Ukraine, actually, Chuck Colton and I were in Morocco watching Morocco use weaponized migration against Spain, because there's these two Spanish city enclaves, which are EU, right? Spain's in the European Union, and they're in Africa, right? These two Spanish cities called Ceuta and Melilla, they're actually in Africa. They're in Morocco, right? They're enclaves on the sea, right? And so they were pushing aliens over the wall. And so Chuck and I were there. We were like out where they were living in the rocks and stuff. It was pretty amazing. And then Chuck noticed up in Poland, I forgot the name of the organization, but they reported that that Belarus was pushing aliens to Poland and to Lithuania, right? So I called up a senior officer in the Lithuanian army because I had been with the Lithuanian army in Afghanistan. In fact, they, were very helpful to me. And so we've kept in contact ever since, right? And since I was with them in the war, I have good contact. So I called up Lithuania and I said, hey, what's up? I see Belarus is trying to pump you with some migrants here. And they said, yeah, we just noticed you're in Morocco. We were about to message you coincidentally. And I said, well, I can be there tomorrow. So we flew up there and we immediately got off the airplane, went into meetings with senior governmental people, and I stayed for 5 weeks. They gave me complete access to the camps. I started mapping out the routes by talking with Chechens and others that were coming in. I'm like, how are you getting here? The Africans, how are you getting here? How are the Kurdish people getting here? Yazidis and all these guys. So I'm mapping this out. And, if you'll notice, when I was in Lithuania, if you look at the things I'm publishing, you'll see news reports where Lithuania just closed the border completely. Like I was at a table with all these guys and they're like, well, hey, we know you study this stuff, like they're intel guys and stuff. And they're asking me, what would you do? Would you put them all in one big camp or many smaller camps? I'm like, smaller camps for sure. It's like, and keep the Chechens separate, right? They're like, we already do that actually, because the Chechens reach critical Chechen mass at 6, right? Like, so I went to this one camp and they literally had 6 Chechens. And some of them spoke German, and I speak German, so I was rapping with those guys. They were actually going back to Germany. So I said, you know, put them in many small camps, keep them divided up and close the border. I mean, close the border. Nobody gets through, right? Do not let them go to Germany. Don't let them go anywhere. So you'll notice when I'm there, Lithuania announces that they've closed the border, right? And so, I mean, you have to put that friction up. Actually, it's kind of an impossible border to really shut. But what they did was they created more friction and it started backing up in Belarus more, right? So then it was causing problems with Belarus. And so they stopped pushing that route as much. So basically the friction that you created decreased the flow. There was no real osmotic pressure there that wasn't being facilitated. They were flying through Turkey, just like Istanbul right now. People fly every day from Istanbul, from Africa to Istanbul to Bogota. China, Istanbul, Bogota. Age all over the Asia from to Istanbul, Bogota, right? And then they end up either taking a flight to these other places we could talk in detail about, like there's an island. And anyway, or they go through the Darien Gap. There's many different routes that we didn't have time to talk about when you were in Darien, but we've got capillary maps.
So I love it because it is blood flow, a little friction, you know, put a little occlusive clot, you know, not a full embolism, but you just stop the flow and the blood has to go other ways. So, but hold on. Groningen, Nord Stream, Darien Gap. What is this paradigm? Let's paint the paradigm before we get down to the details. What is it? I want to know what the map is so that we understand what we're looking at when we see the squiggles on it, right? So this paradigm, what is it that's happening here that connects Groningen, Nord Stream, BASF, Darien Gap?
One thing that you've been talking about for a long time now is food issues. We're clearly going into global famines. It's a matter of time. Again, very long flash to bang. So it's, you know, the separation between, you know, Nord Stream and Groningen and all these other nitrogenous fertilizer interruptions and whatnot, the flash to bang is quite long. And as you know, as a farmer yourself, even if you stop getting fertilizer that year, you can still grow a crop the next year and whatnot, but it starts to decrease, right? You know, I flew from, okay, the substrate of this is, I'm taking the World Economic Forum at their word, and keep in mind, I watch CCP quite closely as well, Chinese Communist Party. And as I mentioned to you before, I've written 3 books on Chinese information war. They're only in Japanese. They're not in English because I've been working for years to wake up Japan. Japan is a crucial partner for the United States. So that's why I focus so much on Japan. I focused so much on Thailand before for other related reasons. If you web search my name in Thailand, you'll see me flying around with the prime minister in the little jet and all that sort of stuff, right? So I think we're going into global famines that are manufactured, right? And so, and it's clear that the population reduction is on the way. You've talked about the death jabs a lot. It's very clear. And again, we have to use proper terminology here. These are clearly not experimental vaccines. As you well know, they're not vaccines. And I see no evidence that they're experimental. I mean, that's just a term that they throw out, experimental. I mean, where's the evidence that they're experimental? They could have made these things 20 years ago, right? I mean, they could have been, these could be well-developed weapons. They are clearly being used as weapons. What is a weapon? Anything that you use as a weapon is being used as a weapon. And these are very smart people that we're going up against, extremely smart. And of course they would have thought this through. I mean, anyway, but so what we're seeing is multiple different things going on. One is global depopulation. So we're going to see huge human osmotic pressure as these economic and food issues and other, you're always talking about energy, as you know, that energy prices rise, all prices rise, right? And so that creates a lot of human osmotic pressure, the push and the pull of migration, hop, human osmotic pressure. Look at the Darien Corridor. If you wanted to flood the United States with half the planet, I would push them right through that corridor. And notice the bridge that I took you to down in Darien, I'm always down there looking, and one day I saw them breaking ground. And notice they kept that out of the Panamanian press. I was back up in Panama City telling, hey, what's up with that bridge down there? And government officials are like, what bridge? There's no bridge being built in Darien. I'm like, you see that mud on my boots? I was just at the bridge. You know, before I took you guys down there, it was one rainy day. It was all slippery, muddy. I was down there and I'm like, they're clearly building a substantial bridge, which you've now seen. This will clearly bridge with Colombia, right? Now you see the Chinese have published a book about the Belt and Road Initiative and Panama, right? Which I showed you in English. It came out in Spanish. I've got the English version, which I've read. It has a map going right through Darien. You know, of course they're deforesting. They're taking the trees down there, which are probably worth billions of dollars. I mean, some of those trees are literally, now the Indians that you were with in Barra, they'll sell those trees for like $20 each, except for the Coca-Cola trees, which is about $2,000 per ton, I think. But some of those trees are, they're like drugs. They're worth a lot more when you make chess pieces out of them or find furniture for UAE, you know, people in Dubai or China or whatever. So, I mean, there's trees that can be worth $1 million, right? By the time you actually make it into some final product. That jungle down there has got to be worth way up in the billions, right? This is not like worth millions, you know. This is it's a beautiful jungle and it's being destroyed. Anyway, back to the paradigm. It's clear that the Chinese Communist Party has made a very tight relationship with the World Economic Forum, and that the World Economic Forum is itself just a sort of affront, I think. But it's an amalgam of interest, right? It's a lot of people with different interests. You got, for instance, Gates is doing the vaccines, quote unquote. You've got Andy and taking as much control as he can over food supplies. For instance, creating a huge food distribution network in Europe called Picnic. I think he's put, mm-hmm. I've forgotten how many hundreds of millions. Actually, three of them have burned down in Netherlands. I went to one of them. It was still smoking, actually. I was over in Netherlands and doing research, and it was in the news. Hey, the Picnic thing burned down, and all the media showed up. Pretty wild. Somebody, when three of them burned down, it's like you say, once, it's just happened. Twice, it's coincidence. Three is enemy action. You know, I suspect somebody's mm-hmm. burning those down, obviously. And so, but the paradigm, it's clear that we've got people, a depopulation event is underway. The death jabs clearly are part of that, right? It's the food is clearly, and the energy, right? Now, one of the things that can be counted on through space and time is fights over, obviously, resources, energy, food. I mean, there's been a war over whale oil. It's not just the current sort of oil, right? I mean, but routes, the Silk Route, you know, the spice route, right? So you've got, you know, the old Silk Road is still there, right? And it's still, like now, you see the railway between Shanghai and other feeders in China goes to Rotterdam, the biggest harbor in Europe and one of the top 10 in the world. So that railway, I've been to the Shanghai side in China. It goes all the way across Asia and Europe and goes right there to Netherlands at Rotterdam. Rotterdam is key terrain. By the way, Rotterdam is at the mouth of the Rhine River, which BASF, that's like the Mississippi River for Europe, right? And BASF in 1914, when they started those nitrogenous fertilizer production and they, you know, eventually started shipping it to the world, it goes down the Rhine River and out to the world, right? So it's quite interesting, isn't it? So all these components like the Panama Canal, you know, Matt Tomlett that you met down in Panama. I told him a couple of years ago, I said, as problems accrue with the Panama Canal, keep your eye on the Suez Canal. I think if my paradigm is right, we're going to have problems with the Suez Canal. And now look, right? You got this war, right? Now I would take that a step further. Watch the Straits of Malacca. Watch Hormuz. Obviously, with the Iran thing popping up, I mean, Hormuz, you know, Bosphorus. I mean, there's different. We're clearly being choked down. The key routes, energy, food supplies, long flash to bang. It takes a long time to set the table. One thing I learned in the Army, I was very lucky to be around great officers and NCOs, and they always were pushing me to read history, which I took to quite, you know, I took to it. But they led the horse to water, and I've been drinking that water ever since. And so I've studied a great deal on history since then, and I've been in a lot of that history as it's made now. And, you know, one of the things I've learned is all these patterns, there's nothing new. There's zero new, right? You know, the reasons we fight, the ways that we got new weapons, but the substrate of what it's all about will be about things like ideology, of course, resources, of course, and just many different things, right? And at the end of the road, a lot of this is about energy and about routes. You see, for instance, this war that's kicked up in Israel now. Now, people are looking at this from the microscopic level. They might go, well, that's Hamas versus, you know, blah. But you look at it on a larger scale, you know, the Indo-European corridor is underway right now. It starts, and interestingly, when Abbott announced that he was going to India recently, or he sort of popped up already there, I was like, you know what? I bet he's in Mumbai. I checked. There he is, Mumbai. Well, you know, of course, he would go to Mumbai for different reasons, but it's also the beginning of the new Indo-European corridor, right? And the Indo-European corridor will go straight through, starts at Mumbai, through Saudi, through UAE, Saudi, through Jordan, through Israel and Gaza and Haifa, right? And then up to Europe, right? So this is, there's not, I mean, just going by what you say, this is way more than three. You know what I mean? It's not, mm-hmm. you know, coincidence. Yep. We're way beyond three and four and five and six. You can see that yep. there is a larger architecture. Now, sometimes there's a lot of signal and a lot of noise.
Let me try this.
Go ahead, sir.
So I want to round this out. So the frame I look at this through is, and I really believe that we have to take them at their word, right? And so I've gone to all the WF documents, and they're right out in front with it, Michael. They say, hey, you know, by 2050, we're going to need 3 planets worth of resources. All wars in history have been resource wars, and sometimes power is a source of, was a resource, right? So you had these power wars. We called them religious wars, but really, when you stripped it away, people were fighting over the oldest stuff that people fight over: resources, power, women, usual stuff, land, you know? So here we are. We know we need 3 planets of resources, and part of the reason for that is we have about 2 to 3 billion people in China and India that want to come up to the middle class, and of course they do. I love my life. It's fun. It's nice to live in a house where you flick a switch and a light comes on and the food is not rotting away in a refrigerator. Everybody wants that. But we don't have the resources for that. So the way I look at this is I say, wow, these actions, BASF, Groningen, the migration, the draining of the SPR, the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, the overprinting of money and deficit spending, all of these collectively, each of them weakens the West. Each of them does that. So it feels to me like there's an active program to weaken the West, but there's one statistic, Michael, I know that's going to change by 2030, guaranteed. The United States is about 5% of the world's population, and we're still consuming 22% of the daily oil production in the world. That's going to change. You can't have 3 billion people trying to get up to the middle class, which takes oil, driving cars, you know, all the things that are made with oil, every little thing on my desk, right? You can't have that if 5% of the world's population is consuming it. So this feels to me, forgive my simplistic way of looking at this, but it feels like a takedown of the standards of living and the prosperity of the West in the United States in particular. Would I be wrong for looking at it that way?
No, and it's a self-sabotage. I mean, remember, the highest form of warfare is information war, right? And we have been over generations, actually, you know, basically conditions to, like, you know, I gave a speech in Japan about 10 years ago, and I was talking with all these historians and whatnot. It wasn't a general crowd. It was kind of assisted crowd, let's say, of academic types. I said, you know, I've been all over this world, and when I go to a different country, I'll ask certain questions like, what do you think of your police? What do you think of your military? What do you think of your court systems? Or what do you think of your food prices, blah, blah, blah. You know, I'm taking the pulse, right? And I'll ask them, what countries and cultures do you like and not like? And it's interesting because if you listen to China, to Japanese information war, especially in Japan, you would think the whole world hates Japan. So I'm giving this speech and I say, you know, I've been all over this world and I ask certain questions. And I said, you know, I've only found 3 countries that don't like Japan. And do you know what those countries are? Keep in mind, this is a really educated audience. And people are like, China. I'm like, okay, China. I spent about a year in China. And Korea, okay. Yeah, some Koreans. But actually, most of the Koreans actually seem to like Japanese quite a lot, actually. But you wouldn't know that from the information war. And they couldn't get the third one. They're like, North Korea. Okay, just combine North and South. That's 2, right? What's the third one? Everybody's like, I mean, you can't even think of the third one that hates you, right? You know what I mean? So, I mean, you got this idea that the world hates you. You can't even think of the third one. But there is a third one, and it's the one that hates you the most. Japan. They practically, I think there's a video of that speech on maybe YouTube or something.
Oh, man.
They practically did a standing ovation. And they're like, wow, you know. And I'm like, you know, because I'm American. I love my country, but we're trained to not respect our own country. I lived in Germany for 4 years. Ich spreche Deutsch. I speak German, right? So I hear them talk with them all the time. And Germans don't like Germany a lot, you know? I mean, but when you talk, you know, we did the War Guilt Information Program against the Japanese after World War II. And we taught them to be ashamed of themselves. And basically, from an information war standpoint, we sort of neutered them, right? And that's what's happened to the United States and Germany. I remember when I got stationed in Germany to begin with, and soldiers would say, like, they're not like their grandfathers. These men are, like, emasculated. They're like, you know, and as I lived there for, you know, 4 years, I was like, they are. I mean, there are some German stud men, but I never, like, the men there, I never made good friends with them because I don't make good friends with weak men. You know what I mean? You know, it's like, And I was just like, what's wrong? And as I studied information war, as the years go by, I realized now I've studied information war quite a lot. A lot of American men have been trained to be weak. That's why I've been smashing Joe Rogan so much over recent years, or over recent times, because, you know, he gets on and he talks the good, you know, fighting game and whatnot, but he's always smoking dope, right? He's on the show smoking dope. Hey, you know, yeah, the border's open. That's so terrible. Let's smoke a bong. You know what I mean? It's literally information war. It's literally most, if you're going to poison somebody, most of the meal you get served, like 99.9% of it's going to be great, right? And then that little poison, and that's it, right? And it's the same with information war. Often, everything is exactly what you want to hear until, and go ahead and take that jab, right? Or, you know, let's go ahead and smoke, you know, smoke a joint together, right? It, like, and when Elon Musk got on Joe Rogan, it very much disappointed me, actually, when he did that. I think Elon has since then realized it was a lapse of judgment. But what I'm getting to with that is a lot of the Chinese coming over, some of whom you met down in Darien, Panama, they're doing huge marijuana grows, right? Like in Maine, it's been reported, Oregon, Oklahoma, California, all they're doing substantial, right? And they're also, smuggling fentanyl, right? Which is killing huge amounts of our people, right? And so, meanwhile, you got Joe Rogan basically acting as their advertising for the, you know what I mean? I'm like, do you understand what you're doing? You know what I mean? I'm not making any, actually, people get upset when I say this. They'll go, oh, you're one of those, you know, boomers who, you know, thinks blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, no, actually, you're going to get killed. You're going to die. I'm out here with men who have high testosterone, and they will come and they will kill you, and they will take your woman. And there's not anything you can do about it because you're going to be stupid and high. You know what I mean? And they will bust down your door and they will kill you. That's what they do in a lot of the places they came from. Keep in mind, I spent most of my life out of the United States, and a lot of that time was in wars. And a lot of that time was in other conflicts. You get these high testosterone men, when they're cut loose, look what happened. They just beat up a couple cops in New York. That's nothing compared to what's coming. I've been to where they come from. Some fish just don't mix well in the same aquarium, right? But so back to the paradigm. Under the paradigm that I've been developing is quite predictive now. Like, I think what you'll see is, you'll see, for instance, they'll start desecrating Arlington, that sort of thing. And, you know, they'll close down the VA hospitals eventually, you know, or do so much damage to the VA system that it'll just become like worse than what it'll become, like a hospital system for aliens or something, right? They'll basically muscle out the veterans, and the veterans will say, no, we'll never let them do it. They will. Under my paradigm, they will, because I'm already watching it, right? You know, people are like, they'll never get over our border. Don't mess with Texas. Well, I'm in Texas, and the border's wide open, right? And, you know, and so, you know, I've been highly predictive on Abbott. And you know, in the beginning, when I started going after Governor Abbott, people are like, what? Don't you understand? He's on our side. He's conservative. I'm like, listen, he's World Economic Forum. That's all you need to know. That is the enemy. He has been installed as the governor of Texas nominally, but he is actually basically the invasion chief for World Economic Forum. And I mean, he's facilitating the Chinese and everybody else coming through. Now, he could close that border. People say, oh, he can't close the border. It's like, okay, go ahead and be quiet because you don't know what you're talking about. He can close the border, right? You can close the border by doing vehicle inspections and putting economic pressure on Mexico, right? Now, taking that one step further, people say, yeah, but that'll hurt us too. Yeah, it will, definitely, absolutely. And do it, right? This is a war. We're already being hurt. We're being destroyed, right? And so, but he doesn't do it, right? Mm-hmm. Now, that won't stop everybody from coming through. But often I see interviews practically daily where somebody is talking about, or they'll do a tweet or something, we need to put sanctions on Mexico or Panama or Colombia. I'm like, you don't understand who's doing this. It's not them. We are doing it. We are, as you already know, I've been watching your program. You totally get it. We are funding IOM. We are funding HIAS and NRC and all these other acronyms people probably can't quite track, but there's at least 250 NGOs and IGOs. They're hard to keep track of, actually. And there's at least more than 60 just in Panama, right? And about 62 or so just in the City of Knowledge where you were at for several days, right? And so these people, they get the principal funding source is United States, then Germany, and for IOM, the third is Canada, right? So we're actually invading ourselves. And this is information war that created the conditions for this. And again, one of the things I learned as a very young soldier is often when it comes time to the actual fighting, it's almost a foregone conclusion before you even start if you are competently led and resourced and with, you know, and everything is done as well as you can do it, which, you know, there'll always be some sloppiness in war. But the wars can be almost, the battles can be almost a foregone conclusion if you've set the table, right? If you've set conditions for your success. And what's happening right now in my paradigm, in my working paradigm, is that the food conditions are being set for global famines, right? Conditions are being set for civil war in the United States. That's why I returned to the United States in late 2020. I think it was August. That was when I'd already been watching your show for several months at that point. And I'm like, you know what? The United States is actually, I can clearly see it's going into civil war. And that's why I returned from Asia, actually. So anyway, paradigm, just every day, just start with something and see if it's predictive. And if your paradigm, if you, anytime you feel surprised, recalculate, and your predictive abilities should go through the roof. So whenever, every time Abbott comes out and says, hey, we're going to put, you know, the rubber ducks in the Rio Grande or whatever, I don't even read the documents anymore because I already know what uniform he wears. It's World Economic Forum. We know how it ends. You know, you just skip to what the paradigm predicts and see if it's accurate. And it's, so far, it's always accurate on Abbott.
And the and what's coming gap. Next.
And also the screwworms. And the screwworms. Remember the screwworms I was talking about in Panama. I've been talking about the screwworms for 2 or 3 years now.
This is an actual pest we're talking about now. So this is an agricultural disaster if you get these things. So what is a screwworm? Just so people know.
A screwworm is a parasite. It's a flesh-eating parasite. It can get in humans too, but it, you know, can tear up cattle, anything with meat, basically. And so our grandparents, they fought a lot of wars that we never saw because they won and they're just lost to history. But there used to be a terrible screwworm problem in the United States. It cost billions of dollars, whether cattle and everything else. So our grandparents fought those screwworms and pushed them out down into Mexico, down through Central America, down through Panama, and the front line is the Darien Gap, right? So the USDA has this screwworm program. They irradiate billions of flies, and then they crop dust those flies over the Darien Gap. So that's another reason why the Darien Gap is very important. It's also the front line against screwworms, right, and other things, right? And so I started looking into screwworms maybe, I don't know, 3 years ago, maybe something like that. And I was like, you know what? If the paradigm is right, those screwworms will end up back in the United States. Because the USDA is clearly captured. And when I reached out to USDA in Panama, they were cagey, you know, and because I wanted to come interview them. Of course, I was, you know, vanilla in my request. But I've dealt with so many governments around the world. When there's a certain response and the way it comes, you're like, they're hiding something, right? I've been doing this too long. This nose is good, you know. And I'm like, and as soon as their response, I started telling I told Matt Tomlett, that you know, and a few other people, I'm like, we're going to have a screwworm problem. There's something going on here. They're covering it up. And I can smell it. And it's got the odors in the room. And so, as you know, just about, I don't know, 2 days ago now or a day and a half ago, there was an article of a screwworm outbreak. Where was it? El Salvador, right? They're moving north. You know, I always pay attention to veterinarians. Todd Bensman and I, Todd's an author and a former intel guy, very smart guy to listen to, actually. We were briefing some bigwig Texans last year, right? And, oh, gosh, Todd's a good guy to have on your show, by the way. Anyway, I should just cut it off there and let you, if you have any specific, because I'll run off all day.
So not just the screwworm, though, and this could be an agricultural disaster, but you've been talking for a while about, now we've been seeing the headlines, tuberculosis is back in the United States, yellow fever is maybe going to make. So if your paradigm is right, all these diseases are going to follow this migration, but it's part of it, like that could happen, but we would have active programs to intercept, interdict, and maybe treat and somehow squat, but that's not happening, right? Like I read about, like, oh gosh, no. Tuberculosis is somehow magically in the United States, and I read these articles, like, how do they not know where this came from? That's the easiest, most basic journalistic like trail to follow. That's not like a trail of breadcrumbs. That's a set of loaves that heads in a certain direction. I mean, this is easy. And I have nobody connects those dots, which means they don't want to, right? So that's part of the paradigm.
Yeah, and actually I've been predicting the tuberculosis in like 100 interviews for a long time. And finally people are like, wow, how did you know that? And I'm like, because millions of people are coming into the United States from places like Pakistan and Afghanistan. This isn't rocket science, you know what I mean? It's like, you know, if big sparks land on you. Hey, here's Doc Chambers, by the way, Green Beret doctor, right? And Alan Chris Martinson. Well, you probably know each other. But
hey, Doc, good to see you.
Retired Green Beret doctor. We're often on the border.
You were talking about tuberculosis. We had 17,000 Haitians show up in Del Rio last year. The doctor for the Department of Homeland Security showed up and said, we're not really worried so much about the COVID. We're more worried about the tuberculosis. Straight up.
So it's on their radar, though.
Yeah.
Tuberculosis, man.
Yep. It is on the radar.
But it's still here. They didn't stop anything. Let me finish that story. I'll tell you about Todd Bensman and I. We were briefing some big wig Texans last year, and there was two veterinarians there. And whenever I hear veterinarian, I'm like, you know, because pay attention to veterinarians, right? And so one of them is named Michael Vickers, right? So I went over to Michael Vickers, and he's now been a veterinarian for 50 years. He used to be, you know, advisor for the governor and all that sort of stuff. So I started talking with him, and we talked for a long time, for like on day one and day two. And so finally, you know, I've kept in contact, and I was asking him about screw worms. I was asking him about tuberculosis and, you know, kids in the cattle and that sort of stuff. And actually, his specialty was anthrax, right? So he's the one that actually found that anthrax that was used on the 9/11 attacks. I think he had found that in the 1980s in Texas. And because it was from China, actually. Let him explain it. I can introduce you to him. But anyway, so as we were doing Operation Burning Edge on the border with Ann Vandersteel and our team down there, I asked Dr. Vickers, will you come down and brief our team on Operation Burning Edge? So he drove, you know, like 5 hours, came down. He briefed us all day and into the night, into dinner. This guy knows, listen, nobody knows tuberculosis like Dr. Vickers, you know, because, you know, he sees, you know, the different strains and the way that they come in. And also he knows about anthrax because he's actually an anthrax specialist. But he said, you know, we don't have any screw worm problems. And I said, well, can you let me know if you see any pop up? Because I think they're going to come back. And he's like, why do you think that? And I'm like, I told him what I told you. And I said, I just smell it, you know? In any case, he said, actually, we have a problem with these ticks, though. There's these ticks that are problematic, and those are coming up. And it'd be better for scientists to scientists to talk. I can introduce you. But he can, and, you know, actually, he lives on the border. He started, I mean, we were talking about anthrax and tuberculosis and the ticks and all kinds of things. But a lot of aliens come through his property, and he's got, like, he started showing us photos of all these dead bodies. He finds dead migrants on his property constantly. It's unbelievable. Yeah. And somebody in our team said, why aren't there more bones out there in the desert of humans? He goes, because like the cattle and stuff eat them, you know. He's like, it's minerals. I mean, they just vanish. You know, they get eaten. And anyway, Dr. Vickers gave us a full, like, totally late into the night briefing. But he talked about the tuberculosis and how, you know, it can go, you know, from the cattle and that sort of thing. But the bottom line is a lot of this stuff isn't hard to predict. It's like as hard to predict as you may have a forest fire if it's super dry and there's kids playing with fireworks and gas, you know? It's like, so when it comes to the screw worms, though, that's a little bit higher level prediction because that, my prediction is based on the paradigm that USDA has captured, and they will sabotage us. They will either intentionally sabotage us, or they're just completely incompetent, woke LGBTQ training, and they're just not doing their jobs. And then when I reached out to them for an interview in Panama, they were cagey. It smelled up the room. When I go back down there, I'm going to ask them again. Actually, I'll get somebody else to ask them, which they'll probably see this interview and go, don't let anybody in. But again, it doesn't matter if you don't let anybody in. If we want to penetrate you, we will penetrate you. You know what I'm saying? And we will definitely know what's going on in your offices. But and the more that they hide, the more that makes us curious. And why are these screw worms out? So I put it on X a couple of days ago that I hyperlinked or whatever it's called to the 10 governors of the top 10 cattle producing states in the United States. I said, the screw worms look like they're making a comeback. You need to send entomologists and veterinarians right now to Panama and other places in Central America and get on this. And I hyperlinked to, or whatever it's called, to Abbott and, South Dakota and Kansas and Florida, the top 10 beef producing states. Let's see.
Well, now it's in terms of these diseases and parasites to the WEF crowd, is this a feature or a bug of the program?
I think a feature. I mean, because they clearly want to, decrease the human population, and they have to hit us with, all kinds of weapons, death jabs, food issues, weaponized migration. They're hitting us with like an octopus on acid. You know what I mean? It's like, yeah. Getting us with, and actually they would be easy to take out if we had a very serious president, right? If you had a very serious president and he was willing to really come in and take it, he'd be taking some physical risk, but mm-hmm. he would have to come in and just basically fire all the top generals in the U.S. military, right? I mean, you'd be like promoting lieutenant colonels up to general or something. We'd probably have a kind of a confused military for a while, but you gotta start, and then you'd have to clean out those lower ranks as well. You'd have to start getting serious Americans in as well. But at some point I would be like, all you people involved in this, fun time's over. You know what I mean? We're going to come get you. You know what I mean? Uh-huh. You're a terrorist, yep. And you are on our bad boy list. And, annual meetings in Davos, done. Not off limits.
Yeah, so I have to.
We know who they are. It's not hidden who they are.
Yeah.
Go ahead, sir.
No, it really isn't. It really isn't. What they're after. This has really been clarifying. And I have to thank you, Michael, because so much has snapped into place. So I'm a thinker, and I'm a systems analyst, and I like to frame things, but ultimately I live by the anecdote, right? My most important things I get are these emails from somebody or this phone call. Like that's where I like to be a futurist. So if I want to know what's going on, it comes from the ground level. So I didn't really know what was happening until I got down there, and I'm able to intuitively pick up and see and feel what's happening. Right. One of the things I have to thank you, Michael, because when you brought me down there, it really snapped a lot of things into focus for me. So here's the way I operate. I'm a systems level guy. I overthink stuff. I'll analyze stuff. I gather all the data, but where I get all my intel from? It's from the anecdotes. Like that's where you see the first stuff moving. Right. And so I really appreciate it. Like you're down there taking pictures of fire hydrants and showing us bridges. And like that's actually, you can see this happening in real time. And it connected a lot of dots. Like the first thing was that I saw that these migrants, this isn't immigration. This isn't even migration. It's an invasion. And when we saw that Red Cross map, which probably had like 200 way station points on it, by the time you have a map on a glossy piece of paper with 200 points on it, this has been operating for a while, right? I mean, this is a rut. This is a well-worn road, of humanity going from A to B. And so when I saw that, I realized, okay, this is it. But this is one of many attack vectors, right? So attack vector one, drain their energy resources and their SPR, take out their Nord Stream pipeline. Attack vector two, take down their ability to make nitrogenous fertilizers so that over time they can make less and less food. Attack vector three, overprint their money and just go like crazy and just weaken their money system. Attack vector four, flood them with people who don't share their culture and who are going to need a lot of resources, who are going to ultimately, be a drain before they're a positive in a country, right? All of that. It's not just one thing. And so when I see these, like the magic holy shots, right? These things like, they take down our particularly the more of them you get, obviously the worse your immune system gets. So it's a direct attack vector. But more than that, it was the people who had to convince themselves that they were doing the right thing and taking the right thing. Like this was a bioweapon for the cognitive assault, right? By the time you've gotten somebody to compromise their integrity, you've gotten a doctor, a pediatrician, an OBGYN to give these shots to pregnant women, to children. They're so compromised. Like, I don't know how they ethically dig themselves back out of that hole again to realize and admit to themselves, maybe they were a participant in something that wasn't so good, historically speaking, right? To be kind about it. So I look at all of that, and what you did for me was frame up too that this is the information war, that this is where the war begins and often is won before any skirmishes are fought. And this is where I started to see what we were really up against. And this isn't something that arose with Biden. This has been many decades in the making, and it goes back to Rockefellers, who knows, right? But it's a thing, and I think people are waking up to that. And so I got to thank you for bringing me down and opening my eyes, because it crisped into focus all of a sudden for me.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. You know, speaking of information war, a man just asked me 2 days ago, they're trying to force him to vax his 15-month-old child. And he was asking me, you know, what doctor could he talk with? I said, follow Chris Martinson. I sent him your website. I'm like, you know, whatever you do, even if you have to run off into the woods and live with your baby, do not put that needle in it. By the way, you know what's interesting on information war is often anytime you feel like an answer comes out of you reflexively, you need to examine that. Like, for instance, if I say CNN is so terrible and corrupted, nobody should ever watch CNN. Now, if somebody then goes, oh, you like Fox. See, that's a reflexive answer, right? That's an answer that's been supplied to you. And that's like, no, actually, I don't like Fox. And, you know, I don't watch them either, right? And so, I mean, they're part of the same ecosystem, ultimately, right? It's the same thing, right? But anytime you feel like, Coca-Cola, blah, 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 is the finest soft drink, you think Pepsi, right? So the Coke versus Pepsi, you know, competition makes you think only in terms of Coke and Pepsi or Ford and Chevy, right? You know, so then you start, if you're fighting over these two, of course, the shareholders are probably the same people, right? You know, you're fighting over, is it going to be Coke or Pepsi? It doesn't matter. Shareholders are probably the same anyway. And, but you're not thinking about anything else. You're not thinking about milk or water, right? And so these are little distractive things that are quite effective, right? So anytime you feel like just something pops out, for instance, with the death jabs, right? Once people realize they are dangerous, I think the average person now realizes this is straight up dangerous. And, and wildly dangerous and probably a weapon. I mean, to me, it's like transparently, nakedly a weapon, right? But now I'm on this group with a bunch of scientists, like physicists and whatnot. I'm on some interesting chat groups, and I'm usually like the odd guy out. Like, I'm on this one group with Orthodox Jews, and I'm the only goy. And it's pretty wild. So I learn a lot being like, and so this group of scientists, they were going off about the jabs last year or so. And I said, you know, I'm never going to take another one, period, because the idea came up, you know, this is hurting, you know, real vaccination programs. And so when I say I'm never going to take another one anyway, and a lot of people watching this now might think, well, that means you would not take the measles vaccine. Those people kept saying measles, right? So you started seeing people say measles, measles, measles. So you wouldn't take the measles vaccine, which has, you know, what are not a 14 or 17 or whatever measles is, right? I mean, it's a really, it really gets out there, right? And but notice so many people said measles, and that answer was put into the blood flow, right? You know, when you talk information, yes, is almost like all these tributaries that come in from the mountains, you know, and if you want to poison that stream, you don't have to poison the main river. You just poison it up there somewhere and it gets out there. Measles, measles, measles. And I said to him, I said, you know, I'm the least educated person on this chat. Again, I don't even know why I'm on it, but why would you take something that comes from the same people that make the obvious weapon? Yeah, but that's a measles. I'm like, that's a label is what it is. You're saying because it says measles on it, I should take, well, that's good. They killed me. They tried to kill me with this one, but this is going to save me from measles, right? According to the paradigm, you know, those pharma guys are completely captured. I mean, I don't even know if they're captured. They're just owned. You know what I mean? They are the beast, right? And they're part of something larger, right? And so why would you take something, you know, okay, that guy tried to shoot me, but he's going to serve me a nice meal now. Okay, thanks for the steak. Again, so they get people fighting over, whether the measles vaccine is good or not. And, you know what's interesting? I read a lot of history, as you know, and I mentioned to you when we were in Darien about this one book that I read on a smallpox vaccine. I think it's from 1889. Actually, I got it on this iPad, and it's a really interesting book. I like to read old books because from the old books, you know, the old books are safely removed from now. And if you read that, I think 1889 book on the smallpox vaccine, everything that's happening could have been this morning, changed the names. Same way with the leper colony. I read a book called The Colony about the leper colony in Molokai, Hawaii. They started, what, in 1866? You read about what happened there, could have been this morning. I sat at the table I'm at right now, just a few days ago, and I was talking with a serious pharma guy, right? And he was telling me about all this behind-the-scenes stuff. And I'm like, you know what? All this stuff that you're telling me about what happened behind the scenes during all this, I've read it all in a lot of old books, just changed the names. You know, Robert Koch was like the Fauci of the, of his time. You know what I mean? You know, he was the Fauci of the 1890s. You know, he did great work on the postulates of, you know, Koch's postulates with, you know, serial passage and whatnot, which this is your world we're talking in now. Mm-hmm. But then it comes up to the 1890s, and now we're back to tuberculosis, and he came up with a remedy. There's a good book on this called, predictably, The Remedy. So he comes up with the remedy for tuberculosis. And it turns out that it was, you know, he just started cashing in. He ended up running off to Egypt with some 19-year-old girl to, you know, avoid everything. But he had gone, you know, he'd gone from really a great scientist, you know, the Robert Koch Institute for microbiology type stuff, into basically the Fauci of the 1890s, right? That's the thing that one of the things I've noticed, Chris, is in all these old books that I've read, is the patterns are quite clear. Rich people die first in pandemic. It's amazing how quickly the rich people die. Because they can afford the miracle cures. They can afford to jump the line, right? Over and over and over. It's like, here's the wealthy and the king's dead. I was flying up from Panama to Mexico a few years ago. And when they were right at the beginning of all the jabs, right? And I was with Misako. We were actually tracking some alien flows. So we were tracking some people that we had tracked through the gap, and they were from Colombia through the gap up through, we met them in Colombia, and now they were in Mexico. So we're flying up to interview them in Mexico. And on this flight, there was a Brazilian young woman, maybe she was a young university student, like young 20s, and her brother, right? And they were sitting beside me, and they're like, their English was very good. They were clearly very affluent. And they were flying to the United States just to get the jab and fly straight back to Brazil. And I said, she was a very pretty girl. And I said, you know, probably won't listen to me because I'm just some old white guy sitting beside you, American, but please don't do it. Don't do that thing. I mean, nothing could go right with it. And actually, I kept in contact with her and her brother, and I think that they did take the jab. But again, they were obviously very wealthy. They were flying up from Brazil just to get the jab and go straight back to the United States. So they had, you know, the wasta, as they would say in the Middle East, the ability just to fly in and fly out. No visa problems, no money problems, go straight back to school. But that's an example of how the wealthy people get knocked in the head during pandemics or fake pandemics, right? They get the miracle cures. And of course, when you got all the money of the king, you know, there will definitely be a miracle cure for you when you're sitting on a pile of gold and you're willing to part with it. Just keep that in mind. Yeah.
Well, it was very tragic, but you know, the heir to the Thai throne was killed by the jabs, right?
That's right. She took. I happen to know one of her doctors and a good friend of mine, and she had two AstraZeneca and two Moderna, and I mean, she was, you know, he was there. I mean, she's still a vegetable, and you know, it's obviously problematic. Because I think, anyway, I can't go into much details beyond that, but, right. And obviously that's a problem. It's a problem for Thailand in general, because she was, there's nobody that can really take the throne at this point. You know, I flew back from London. I was just over in Ireland with Misako. We were looking at food issues in Ireland and also the migration issues in Ireland, invasion. And we were out there, very interesting. And so we left in Ireland. We were doing the food thing, and we talked with Mary Lou McDonald, the leader of Sinn Féin. What a goofball, man. She's got an IQ of about 80. Total left wing, you know, and we're out at a bar with her. I don't drink, but, you know, but she's doing the Irish thing. And I wanted to talk about food, and she's like, oh, you know, we're doing the equity and equality. And I'm like, this place is lost. So anyway, Misako found a Chinese police station there. We went to that. She published it. Then we went back the next day or so, and they had taken the sign off. This is in Dublin, right? And then we left from there and went over to London, and Misako found another police station. And I don't know how she found this one, but somehow she found it, and Japanese were talking about it. And so we found it. They had no sign. So we get, this is nondescript neighborhood in London. And I was like, this is, So she's like, I think it's this weird place. So I said, well, just push the button and say, ni hao. And she did. She, you know, ni hao, hello in Mandarin. And they started rapping to her, and Mandarin's like, bah, bah, bah. And she's like, oh, you know, she doesn't speak. She's Japanese. She doesn't speak Mandarin. But anyway, then they're like, oh, no. You know, she's like, oh, is this the police station? And they're like, oh, no, no, no. But anyway, bottom line, we left London, and we flew over to London was quite interesting. We went into this giant mosque, and oh, it's unbelievable. So then we flew to Thailand, because I went to see one of the old prime ministers. He's a friend of mine. Mark Abhisit, right? Or his nickname is Mark. So I said, hey, I'm in London. Can I fly over to Bangkok and talk with you about some stuff? So I flew over there, and we're sitting at a table in a coffee shop. And I said, you know, I think we're going to have some food problems, and Thailand can be affected, right? And he goes, oh, you know, because, you know, I got an office in Thailand. I've been to every province of Thailand. I'm pretty familiar with it. Like, there's a canal they want to build on the Kra Isthmus, by the way. Very interesting. I mean, I've been down there scouting it out. The Chinese are buying the land. And anyway, it's a whole nother story. But the and they're building their train through there as well. And so so I said, you know, I think you could end up with a food problem here. And he goes, oh, you know how much food we export? We're the major exporter of rice in Asia and da-da-da-da-da. And I was like, yeah, but you import 92% of your nitrogenous fertilizers. You only create 8%. And as you know, rice is basically a nitrogen vacuum. So you're basically exporting nitrogen, right? And I've already checked. You know, I didn't fly all the way from London to talk with you just to have coffee, right? You know, it takes a lot to get my attention. I flew all the way to Thailand because I think Thailand could end up ultimately having problems with this. And now they are having some problems, actually. But he's like, oh, no, we'll just get it from China. And I'm like, check it. I didn't fly over here without checking that first. He's like, we'll get it from Russia. I'm like, again, check it. You know, I mean, there's some problems. Mm-hmm. There's more to this problem set than meets the eye. And again, it's got a long flash to bang. They are still creating a lot of food, a lot of rice. You know what's interesting? In the 1960s, Thailand was having a protein problem. And the king of Thailand back then, King Rama IX, he was a good guy. You know, he's one of the, you know, I'm Scott Irish American. We don't like kings, but I liked him, actually. He was really squared away. I go all over Thailand, man. I'm way out in the jungle in some village. They don't even have electricity, and they'll have a picture of the king in that village, not next to the waterfall or something. I'm like, is there any place in Thailand he hasn't been? I'm talking the former king, King Rama IX, right? And so it's King Rama the 10th now. But so I was out there and I'd studied quite a lot on Thailand and various things. But in the 1960s, Thailand had had a protein problem. And so he was on it, man. It's the famine you never heard of, right? He's like, hey, we got a problem. We got to get on this. So he assembled a team. I talked with one of his old team members. He was in his 80s when I talked with him. And he's like, yeah, we did all this, the other things. But finally, the king reached out to his friend, King Crown Prince Akihito in Japan. And he said, so Crown Prince Akihito sent these Pra Nil, as they call them in Thai language, which is like it's a Nile perch. Yeah. So he sent these fish over and he said, look, this is what we've done in famines in Japan. They built fish ponds all over the place. And Misako and I have traveled around Japan studying what Japan has had a lot of famines, right? So they have a lot of ancestral knowledge on famines. So we went over there studying it. They built fish ponds and stuff. So he sent these pra nil, or in Thai language, I forgot what they're calling in Japanese. But anyway, he sent these Nile perch over to Thailand. And now when you go around Thailand, you see fish ponds. It looks like the moon, man. There's so many craters. You know, they dug out fish ponds everywhere. And so they never had a famine because, you know, he saw it coming in advance, right? And that's one thing I've learned in the study of famines. There's always that 1% who actually do see it. Like like the screensaver on my phone, I may have showed you in Panama, is one of those guys, Kenjiro in Japanese. And he was an autodidact. He taught himself everything. His parents got messed up in a big flood. This is the 1700s. And he was one of those guys that saw a famine coming, right? And he saw, for instance, the leaves were coming off the trees early in the year. And he said the eggplants tasted like fall eggplants, but it was only like in the summer eggplant. And he's like, oh, there was all these. I'm sure a lot of the story's lost because we're talking, you know, a couple hundred years ago now. But so there's a statue of him in every Japanese school, right? There's even a statue of him in Los Angeles. I found it and went to it actually. But he saw it coming, and he was able to persuade the people around him, like, don't plant rice now, plant millet, because I think the summer's going to end soon, and it'll kill your rice and stuff. Anyway, he persuaded. There was a lot of other people died, but nobody in his area died. So after that, all the leaders wanted him to come around and advise them, and he did. So the rest of his life, he would go around and advise and how to do. And there was other people in Japan that did this too. There was some small percent there's that percentage that can see it, but then there's that smaller group that can actually effectively do something and organize people, right? And get people together talking about, like, Phil Waldron's one of those guys. I'm literally sitting in a beehive of everybody. Like last night, this room was completely filled with people who are discussing how to raise rabbits and chickens and all kinds of stuff, right? I mean, last night they were talking about financial stuff, but I mean, he's basically Kenjiro of Dripping Springs, you know what I'm saying? But there's always that small percentage that prepares their, that's what you're doing, right? You're another Kenjiro. You're preparing your tribe. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, a lot of the times, all the people that prepared, they get right through. And they just go, wow, that was terrible. but they're alive and they live to tell the tale, yep. Right? Yeah, Japan is a good place to go to study famine. They've had a ton of famines. Almost nobody knows about them.
Well, so last question, because we got to wrap up here. But you mentioned that your framework, your paradigm says you started with this very early on, and now we're discussing it more directly. Question: is famine on the way, and why do you think so?
If the paradigm I'm working with is accurate, definitely we'll end up with famine, and it'll be the biggest famines in human history if my working model is accurate. First of all, look at what happened in Nord Stream, Groningen, and so many other things. I mean, that we're not even talking about. You see the problems in the Suez now, which again, that I was telling Matt about this. You met in Panama a couple of years ago. I said they're going to end up having a problem in Suez. Just watch. If the paradigm is accurate, we're going to end up with a problem there. We're going to end up with Straits of Malacca. We're going to end up with a lot of different problems, right? You know, I don't know if Matt told you this, but just some months ago, there was the big violence in Panama. And I told Matt, I said, you know, it's just a matter of time until some white guy shoots somebody in the street and it causes people to turn against white people in Panama. And the very next day, a white guy did it. And notice there was a camera right there, total, like, got the shell casing coming out of the pistol. I mean, it's like a perfect, like, that photographer was in the exact right spot. Everything was like, because that's what I was telling them. They'll stage something like that, right? Now, it did cause a lot of anger against white people in Panama for a very brief time, but it turns out he's actually a Panamanian citizen. So that mitigated it. I didn't know he was going to do that. I was just saying, if the paradigm is accurate and I know what they're trying to do, they're trying to get rid of the white people in Panama. Not all the Panamanians. I mean, you're welcome in Panama. As you felt, you were in Panama for a week. You feel extremely welcome there. We were all over the place. And But there are other powers that be that want all the Caucasians gone, especially Americans, right? And they want all, because that's a, you know, for various reasons, different entities want us gone. And that, again, I was just going by the paradigm, like, you know what? Mm-hmm. They'll have a white guy shoot somebody in the street. The next day it happened. Perfect photography. Coincidence? Maybe.
Mm-hmm. Well, Michael, I can't wait to see you again and maybe come back to Panama for sure. But please keep doing what you're doing. And before we close up, tell people how they can follow you and maybe contribute to what you're doing, because I know you are supported by donations and things like that.
You can follow me by going to the nearest war, and I'll be there. Dark humor of war correspondent. Actually, I don't go to most wars, actually. I only go to the ones that are extremely important for us. I'm not going, like, I didn't go to Ukraine. I'm not taking chances on that nonsense. That's unbelievable. Mm-hmm. That's obviously part of it. But I'm on X every day, you know, former Twitter, formerly known as Twitter, and Substack and locals.com. But I'm on X, actually, every day.
All right.
Thanks, Chris.
Michael,
I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for your time today.